We're talking about America's lumber crunch and what effects the shortage is having on Wisconsin builders. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Lumber is very expensive and in short supply. It's all over the headlines, this lumber mania, as Vox called it. And we wanted to find out what the implications are for Wisconsin. Are you building a new home, or are you a contractor who needs wood to do your jobs? Maybe you work at a mill. Maybe you're a logger. Share what you're experiencing in the supply chain with the wood supply shortage, the costs, 800-642-1234. Zach Schultz is a reporter for PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now. He's been reporting on the state of the lumber industry. Zach, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, put this in perspective for us. How high is high? What is happening in the lumber industry with the costs?
Well, one of the ways that the industry itself measures the cost of lumber is by what's called composite board feet, 1,000 composite board feet. And that's just adding up all the 2x4s or all the plywood and putting them together. And a year ago, 1,000 composite board feet was going for around $353.
Mm-hmm.
Just last week, it was $1,359. So we're looking at tripling and approaching quadrupling the cost of 1,000 board feet for the exact same 1,000 board of feet for lumber in just a year. And really, they don't see an end in sight anytime soon.
So all the finger pointing as to why the spike, why the soaring costs. Take us back in time. What is contributing to these prices?
It's supply and demand, and the problem is on both ends of that equation. There isn't enough supply. There really wasn't quite enough supply before the pandemic, and then it got a lot worse. And demand has dramatically increased since the pandemic started. Now, the demand, I think most people can understand. People who've been working remotely have been feeling like they're stuck at home. They wanted to remodel. They want to build a new deck, maybe add on to the house. They've got some increased money. And so that demand is there. Other people saying, I'm getting out of the city. I got to build a house out in the country. Housing starts are way up over recent years. So the demand is there for more lumber to build. Then the supply end, most of the sawmills shut down last spring. They were actually anticipating a poor year for lumber demand because they didn't know what the economy would look like. And it took them quite a bit of time to come back online. And even before the pandemic, there was a question of whether there was enough sawmill capacity in the United States to meet demand.
Hmm. And so there's been some talk about underinvestment in the lumber industry. I wonder if those factors, or maybe that the industry hasn't modernized, kept up with demand.
Yeah, and it depends on what size sawmill you're talking about, because there are some monster facilities that have the most up-to-date technology. And then there's some what you would almost consider the old mom and pop facilities that are still going, that still make a living. They still support the people there. But they haven't quite modernized with all the electronic sawmills. They may still be relying on someone using their eye and a ruler to measure out how to get the best lumber out of or timber out of each log. And the capacity isn't there for what they need. Now, there's more in the pipeline, but we're still looking at a couple years away from some of that capacity coming online.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Zach Schultz, who's a reporter for PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now. He's telling us about his reporting on the lumber industry and what's behind the rising cost and tight inventory. Have lumber prices put a wrench in your building plans? What are you seeing at your local hardware store? Have you put your projects on hold because of lumber? 800-642-1234. Anthony is with us from Stevens Point. Hi, Anthony. I understand you're a contractor.
Yes, I work with contractors, and I'm a radon mitigator in our area. And one of the things I've noticed, it's not just lumber that's increased. It's also I use pipe for my radon mitigation system. Since last fall, that has doubled. I've noticed that the wiring used for houses, just kind of follow the price on that. Since last fall, that has tripled.
Mm.
So it's not just the lumber industry that's an issue. It's everything involved in the house. And I just talked to one contractor last week, and he had 3 contracts lined up for this year, and everybody backed out of them. So I think this is going to affect the building industry, even though they say that because interest rates are high. It's not, but I think it is.
Well, Anthony, thank you for your perspective from inside the industry. And Zach, this is hitting all aspects of the supply chain.
That's right. Lumber is most noticeable because that's the thing that the average homeowner is still likely to go out and perhaps buy on their own. They might go to Home Depot or Lowe's and look for some 2x4s to do whatever kind of project. They're less likely to be looking for industrial size, you know, lengths of pipe. Or some of the contractors told me that glue, insulation, some drywall. Last year we heard about appliances. Everything in the international supply chain is in flux at the moment. And as soon as you put more demand on it, you find out that there are pinch points in this world trade system. Lumber is more noticeable, but it's there.
You talked with someone who had built a house, I think finished it off last August, and they were trying to compare what that cost of their house would be to build it now. What did they tell you?
Yes, he's a man who lives up in Eagle River. He just built his dream house out in the woods with his family, and he met his builder over the winter, and he had heard about timber prices going up. And he said just casually, hey, how much more would it cost? And the builder said $40,000 to $50,000 more. And this isn't some mansion. I mean, it's a nice house. It's a modern house. But that doesn't even include the pole shed or any of the other things that he wants to build. His wife has horses. And he said, now we have to put our pole shed plans on hold while we figure out how we're going to get money. If the bid had come in at that point and they hadn't been done, he said they would not have been able to build the house.
Yeah, so what happens then when a construction loan is set up to build a new house? How do you account for these prices?
It's if the loan is set and the bank is not able to renegotiate or they're already in the middle of the process, it's usually up to the homeowner to come up with cash on hand. And that can really force people to back out or reconsider. Sometimes if it's a small amount, the contractor can try and eat some of that cost. A lot of contracts come with a little bit of a buffer built into it for these reasons, maybe 10 to 15%, depending on the contract. But that's not enough to handle this rise in increased prices. So a lot of people are just having to back away from a contract right now. I've heard of some contractors who, when they are putting out projections and bids for houses, saying, we're not going to include the cost of lumber at this point.
Wow.
When we get to the point where I'm building it, then I will give you a price. But I can't afford to take the risk that whatever price I set now will be nowhere near accurate 6 months from now when I actually get to putting up your house.
Yeah, I mean, so your contingency fund could be eaten up entirely by the overage cost of your lumber estimates. I mean, it wouldn't allow room for much else.
No, not at all. And what it's doing in some cases is it's pricing out some of the people that are trying to get into their dream homes or trying to upgrade their homes and simply don't have the cash on hand. The wealthy will be able to afford this. The people with bigger credit lines who are starting now will be able to afford this because they can just ask for a bigger loan. But some of the people in that moment will really feel the crunch.
PBS Wisconsin journalist Zach Schultz with us has been reporting on what's behind the incredible rise in lumber prices, what it means for Wisconsin residents. What questions do you have about this supply-demand issue? Are you trying to repair or remodel your home or build one? Are you a carpenter? How has the price of lumber affected your building projects or your customers? And what decisions have you made to make do in this time? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Zach Schultz here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the lumber frenzy, the run-up on wood, and what it means for our state. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the National Association of Home Builders, the price of lumber has tripled in the last year, with the average new single-family home costing about $36,000 more due to the situation. Are you trying to build, or are you a supplier who can't keep inventory on the shelf? What do you think about the Great Recession's impact? 800-642-1234. Zach Schultz is with us, a journalist with PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now, and he's telling about his reporting on the industry. Matt is joining us from Nisida. Hi, Matt. What are you seeing?
Hi there. So we moved into a new-to-us home a couple of years ago, and we've been remodeling it basically since. So very fortunate to have gotten most of it in before these price increases. But pretty major remodel. We're redoing the floor plan, brand new kitchen, plumbing, wiring, everything. We're doing it ourselves. The one thing, two things that I wasn't willing to do was mudding and sanding. Put all the drywall up. I did not want to mud and sand. And we want a picture window. And I just wasn't comfortable putting a large picture window in by myself.
Yeah.
To find someone to come mud and sand took 2 months. 2 months, they're booked out 2 months, and to order the window would be a 3 to 4 month lead time, and to get someone to put that in, we don't even know if anybody has the availability. So it's not just the materials, it's also the contractors that are extremely busy and really can't even, in our experience, take on new work.
Yeah, Matt, thank you for that. And Matt, having so much difficulty even finding a contractor to do the work. You know, Zach, you talked with contractors. What did they tell you?
Right now, their demand is not slowing down. I've got one person I spoke with said that he doesn't even list the houses. He builds them on spec and people just find them through word of mouth and buy them from him. Other contractors are saying they're working 6 months out. There is a fear that there's a bubble out there somewhere because most of these people were around during the last bubble about 15 years ago. But at this point, they're not seeing it. So right now, it's just that natural fear that comes in when the market feels too hot. Mm. But it is crazy right now trying to get anyone to do any labor for you. There are so many people left the industry. There wasn't enough support in the first place that there is a real shortage of people to do some of this work.
Well, let's talk about loggers in this formula. What does the increased price mean for loggers in Wisconsin?
Unfortunately, for the loggers that I spoke with, it doesn't mean much. Some of them are saying that they're actually making less per load than they were a year ago, simply because the cost of everything else has risen. Hmm. They're not seeing the price increases passed down to them, and they're really feeling the pinch. We're seeing people lose the industry, and this could become another supply bottleneck in the future if there aren't enough logging contractors available to cut down the trees and haul them to market.
So what about the sawmills then? Have sawmills been able to see some of these profits?
If you want to find where the money's going, if anyone's making money, it's the sawmills right now. And that depends on the size of the sawmill and how much they're able to produce. But the profit margins for some of the larger companies across the country are going way up right now. One of the sawmills from Wisconsin, they own two mills here, say they're not really seeing too much in price increase in profit, that they're just trying to hold steady, that their costs have gone up for transportation to keep people in the building. And so they're saying they're not seeing all the profit, but compared to the other people who are saying they're seeing none of it or actually losing money, it's pretty evident that if there is profit being made in this, it is going to the sawmills.
Explain for us how lumber prices are set and how they are, you know, go up and down. Can you kind of explain how the market works?
Well, everything is openly traded. There's a futures market for it, just like any other commodity. Timber is considered part of the United States Department of Agriculture, so it's another crop, just like corn or soybeans. But it's on obviously a much different time scale. And the difference with it is most of the people that are harvesting it don't own their own property. The mm-hmm. logging contractors aren't logging on their own land. They're either letting out bids for private or for public land. And one of the groups that incidentally sets a lot of the market prices is a journalist trade organization called Random Lengths. They're based in Eugene, Oregon, and they have market reporters that call around and look for open transactions all across the country and the globe to figure out how much everything's going for. And then they report that. But what we're seeing is some of these sawmills are actually using that reporting to set their own prices. And
wow.
When you speak with the Random Lengths editors, they say, we don't want that to happen because that can dramatically influence what we're reporting. We have to exclude those costs from our actual information. But that does affect the standard where one sawmill is not setting it according to what people are paying here, but what's being paid elsewhere in the country.
We're talking with Zach Schultz, a reporter for PBS Wisconsin's Here Now. He's telling us about the state of the lumber industry and what's behind the high prices. With your insights, 800-642-1234. We heard from him. Bill called in from Superior and said the Louisiana Pacific and Hayward makes plywood. It's not accepting plywood shipments anymore since middle of last year. And Bill said this will not get better even before we get more lumber. 2x4s not $10 instead of $5. So Bill, very concerned about shipments. Jim from Beaver Dam called, couldn't stay. And he knows construction workers that in his area, not skinning houses in plywood anymore, only doing corners for strength, and the rest of the house is getting done with foam board. Do you see on that, Zach, are contractors pivoting with the supplies they're using, with the products they're using to build homes?
There's definitely a shift occurring in terms of how careful they're being with the supplies they can get. I mean, they're going to finish a house any way they can. They're not going to leave people sitting idly by because they can't get the proper materials. It used to be if you framed out a timber frame house, you would have lots of boards used at various times to help support or to hold up an angle or a corner until it got secured. And then a lot of times, if it had two nails in it, they'd throw it in the dumpster because it was worth so little. And now what we're hearing is builders and contractors are being very conscious about trying to reuse anything they can because they know the value in it and they may not be able to replace it.
Wow. Yeah. So certainly conservation there as well. John is joining us from Stevenson, Michigan. John, what are you seeing?
Okay. Hey, listen, we have some standing timber that probably should be cut and harvested. And normally they used to like pay about 25%. Am I expected to get a better price for my standing timber now than before?
John, thank you. Zach, what about the person with a timber stand? Will they get a better price?
When you speak to the loggers right now, the answer is probably no. Unfortunately, the timber is there. I mean, there's wood in a lot of places. It's not that there's not enough of the trees standing. It's simply the sawmill capacity. So until there's more capacity to actually cut that timber into boards, the demand and the price for the actual standing timber likely won't go up anytime soon.
Let's look beyond our borders. What are the impacts of tariffs on this commodity? Are high tariffs causing less lumber to flow into our country?
Absolutely. The Trump administration put tariffs on lumber imports from Canada. And those were lowered last December after they saw evidence that that was not working out well for supply in the United States. But there's still tariffs in place. And a lot of the industry people are hoping that those will actually get wiped out, that that'll increase supply. There's international concerns just with the amount of trees in Canada, because they've had some issues. There have been issues in the Western United States as far as having some of that standing timber capacity and the ability to have access to cut it down. But a lot of the pinch point is not so much in the trees standing, it's elsewhere in the chain.
It's elsewhere in the supply chain. What about any impact of federal aid, federal pandemic aid coming from the government? Is the lumber industry getting any help?
The second COVID relief bill, the one that was part of the ongoing funding of government that was passed last December, did include $200 million for loggers. But that money hasn't been distributed yet. It's been allocated to the USDA, and Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin was one of a number of U.S. senators that sent a letter saying, please release this money. The loggers desperately need it. And the logger I spoke to, who's president of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association, says they have a fear that they're not going to see that money at all, that either the USDA thinks they're the ones getting rich off these increased prices, or because it's part of agriculture, they're going to find some other area that they feel has greater need. So the money is there. It hasn't been allocated. And that's a real concern for loggers that they might never see it.
Jolene called from Viroqua, couldn't stay, and is wondering if you could address whether the cost of crude oil is affecting the industry across the board, along with the price of insulation. And could this be part of a bigger scenario, a bigger picture that goes well beyond lumber prices?
Well, there's certainly transportation costs involved in all of this. It's hard to point to any one other factor for the lumber supply in general. When you look at the overall housing costs, then certainly all of those factors have to be included internationally. But lumber mostly has to do with sawmill capacity at this point. Once that increases, that should open up that to a degree. It just depends on whether demand keeps going up, and that's in part on interest rates and people's willing to pay for new houses.
Right. So this period of low interest rates, really tight existing housing stock, is also really factoring into the equation.
Absolutely. The demand for housing was there pre-pandemic, and it's actually risen since then because so many people are completely reevaluating their lives, where they want to be, where they want to live. I mean, if you want to look at an outside factor that really could impact this, it's the expansion of broadband. The access for people to move to a rural area and build their dream house out in the country and then still work remotely could only increase the demand for timber to build new homes.
Zach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Zach Schultz is a reporter for PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now. His recent piece is called What's Pushing Record Lumber Prices and Who in Wisconsin is Benefiting? We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we ask a security expert for guidance on how to prevent violence within the workplace. Does your workplace run active shooter drills? How often? What happens when you participate? 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're learning about strategies to prevent workplace violence on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Every year in our country, more than 300 people go to work and don't make it home due to a workplace shooting. That's data from the Labor Department. We're looking at what this means for employers in training and in preparation. Does your workplace have active shooter drills? Have you ever witnessed violence at work? What can you share about that incident? It's 800-642-1234. Dick Sem is president and owner of Sem Security Management in Burlington. He's worked in the security industry for nearly a half century. Dick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. What is the first thing you typically tell clients about how to prevent gun violence in their workplace?
Well, it's certainly important to be aware that it's a problem, that it happens or can happen anywhere. I've worked now with 30 facilities following shooting incidents, and the first thing I usually hear is, "We never thought it would happen here." So it's important to understand it's a real thing. Lately, of course, in the news, it's been showing up quite a bit. So people are kind of aware of it now, I think. But that there are things that you can do to prevent it. There are things you can do to safely respond to it. I think you should understand your industry. What might happen in a hospital would be different maybe than what happened in a school or a manufacturer. So there's not a cookie cutter approach to this.
You say you've worked with clients in the aftermath, 30 clients following shootings. What should happen in the debriefing? How should companies learn from workplace violence and put in corrective measures?
Well, needless to say, it's a very traumatic experience for everybody involved, not only those who are close to the event, but everybody in the facility, everybody in the organization will be traumatized. So hopefully, you know, we keep it from happening in the first place. But, you know, often the recovery stage is organizations fail at that point, that they don't provide enough support and guidance and counsel to everybody who's been involved, and it can create a long-term festering effect, affecting morale, productivity, retention. So it's really worth dealing with it early on and properly.
Yeah, the ramifications can last. How can you ensure that employees are comfortable reporting their concerns with management?
Well, there has to be trust. And there has to be some actions taken. If they have a history of reporting incidents and nothing happens, nothing's done, then they become cynical, a little skeptical about reporting. The management, the administration, they really can't deal with it. They can't manage it if they don't know what's happening. Too often, for instance, I work with healthcare a lot, And sometimes people say, well, you know, it's just part of the job to get beat up or get threatened or get assaulted. And they don't even report that. So that's something that has to be addressed.
Hmm. Have you worked with clients that have no prevention steps in place, that they're literally starting from ground zero?
Oh, yeah. That's maybe more often than not. Or they just get download a workplace violence program from the internet that doesn't really apply to them. And there's so many aspects of that, especially at the prevention and mitigation phase. You know, how can we deal with it? Or if we know we have a person, an employee or whatever, a patient who's potentially problematic, how do we mitigate the risk? So there's a lot of steps to this.
Yeah, a lot of steps, a lot of phases. What should companies start asking in that first phase of putting together a plan to prevent this from happening?
Well, first of all, having a plan, having a policy that addresses the organization's real risks and history is important. Having a security program, having training of employees is so essential, that especially frontline employees who deal with the public on how to recognize potential violence, how to de-escalate, what to safely do when they feel at risk. Also, you know, mental health and EAP resources are important, having a relationship with your local law enforcement, are all steps you can take early on to try to prevent it from happening. It's important too to have what's called a threat management program, so that you can how do you recognize a person who is potentially violent, and how do you manage that? How do you assign a level of risk? What I see a lot in organizations is you have somebody who is somehow of concern, and you present them with bad news, which is called a triggering or precipitating event. So it could be a termination or a discipline or refusal of service, whatever. And that could set them off. That could trigger them. And many times that's the situation. So how do you safely plan for that? I can say that probably 95%+ of human resources departments I've worked with really have no formalized program for that. They kind of invented at the seat of the pants as it happens. So it's important to plan for that. So planning in general is important. Training is very essential.
So it's not just about planning for delivering some, you know, probably bad news to a disgruntled employee. There's a whole much more of an orbit of working around that situation and looking at it from all perspectives.
Oh, sure. And there's things you can do. There's all kinds of mitigating steps before, during, and after that precipitating event to keep everybody safe. But if you don't know what those steps are, you know, you're at a loss right from the beginning.
What are some common red flags that you look for in a disgruntled employee?
Well, first of all, it should be noted that workplace violence is not just about the shooter, the active shooter, which of course needs to be addressed and planned for, but it can be any threatening behavior. It can be harassment, sexual or racial harassment. It can be assaultive behavior. That's a big issue in healthcare right now, is assault against staff. So it can be anything. A big issue, I think, maybe the biggest issue I see, is that mental health resources across the country are drying up. There's funding is being cut. The mentally ill and their families have fewer places to go for support, for guidance, help. And that I think that's a real underlying problem to all of this, is that in some ways it's a national shame. Some states are worse than others. I work in most states, so I see where it's really bad, but that's really an early phase when you see somebody who, you know, they've made threats, they're acting unstable. What can you do to give them help, to give them some support early on before it escalates to something worse?
We're talking with Dick Sem, who is president and owner of Sem Security Management in Burlington, and he's telling us how he works with businesses to prevent workplace violence. Are you a manager or supervisor? Do you feel prepared in the event of an emergency or an active shooter situation? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dick, what is behind emergency or safety drills? Do they help? What do they entail?
Well, drills can be useful. The problem with active shooter drills is I think maybe they're being overdone. They're being improperly done. There's a focus, I think, on the mass shooter, which in some environments that's a real issue, especially where there's a concentration of people, like in schools or theaters, places like that, where there's a lot of people in one place. But often, depending on the industry, it's a targeted small event that happens very quickly in a limited area. So, you know, again, if you have a drill, it should be focused on what your real risks are, what's most likely to happen. And of course, the drills themselves, if they're not handled right, they can be kind of traumatic in themselves. So you have to take care on how you do it. And there's ways you can do it sensitively without alarming people too much.
How do you do that? How do you do it sensitively without causing people harm?
Well, for instance, rather than have somebody run around with a toy gun or anything like that, for instance, one company uses the use of, like,
I think we're having some difficulty hearing Dick Sem. He is president and owner of Sem Security Management in Burlington.
Somebody brings in the red, guide them that they need to react then.
Dick, we're going to pause right here with you because we're having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. Dick Sem, he owns a security management company, has clients nationwide as we look at workplace violence, how to prevent it. How have the recent shootings across the country affected you? Do you ever feel nervous about going into work due to these instances of violence in the workplace? Do you have an exit strategy in your mind in the event of an emergency? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Dick Sem right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Worth noting here, entire industries have built up around workplace shootings, from workplace violence management firms to active shooter insurance policies. In light of the recent Green Bay casino complex shooting and last year when 5 people were slain after a coworker opened fire at the Molson Coors headquarters, is your employer doing enough to prepare for potential workplace violence? 800-642-1234. Dick Sem runs a workplace security and violence consultancy firm in Wisconsin. He's with us for about 10 more minutes. Dick, our connection cut out with you when you were explaining these safety drills. What works with them and what doesn't?
Well, again, you need to have a drill that is realistic, but not traumatic. You don't want to frighten people. There's ways to do that. I'm more of a believer than just doing the drills than in doing tabletop exercises where you bring people together, including law enforcement, and you work through these situations and talk through how you're going to manage it, because it's key. You know, these events are usually over within 5, almost never more than 10 minutes. And so how are you going to communicate it? What are you going to do in those critical 5-10 minutes to keep people safe? And so the tabletop exercise may be more useful even than doing a drill. And then you can train people to seek shelter and run, hide, fight, those sorts of things.
What do you think about safe rooms or areas that employees can go as they wait for help to arrive?
Well, I'm a big believer in them. And I think that's a trend in industry. We're seeing it much more. We find that there's two levels of employee exposure. One is those who are proximate to the event, who are right there where it's happening. And, of course, the run, hide, fight is appropriate in that situation. But more often you have everybody else in the building. What should they do? And we find more and more that it's appropriate. If you can seek shelter, if you can go in a safe room and have that shelter for 5 or 10 minutes till the police respond, you buy that time and you're safer. So that's a powerful tool, and I almost always recommend it.
What about restricting access to certain areas of a building, like you have multiple key codes to get onto a floor or into a workplace area? What are your thoughts there?
Well, that can be useful. Some of these industrial incidents are caused by somebody coming from the outside, like an ex-employee, and gaining access. So if there had been some access control, maybe that wouldn't happen. Having those controls within the floors, within areas, can help restrict and keep the person from moving around too much. On the other hand, sometimes it's an employee caused, and so that's an employee who might have a key card. So that's not 100%, but it can be a useful tool.
Are there skills that people can learn in these tabletop exercises on how you prevent people from panicking in a situation like this, or just freezing in a situation?
Yeah, and that's people, I haven't heard too much of people freezing, but people they won't know what to do, where to go. Sometimes they actually move toward the shooter, which of course is counterproductive. So training them in what to respond, knowing where to go, where the safe room is. But the key thing, and the thing I hear almost universally from employees who have survived these events, relates to communications. We didn't hear, nobody told us, we didn't know what to do, they forgot about us. And that's a real serious thing, is organizations need to know in those essential, critical first 5 minutes, what do you say, how do you communicate it, how do you get the word out that what people should be doing immediately. And that's a challenge that's often missed.
You know, that's really striking. You say they forgot about us. What might that situation entail?
Well, for instance, I've seen it before where, let's say, there's a neighboring building or an outlying building, and they forgot to talk to those folks, and yet they're going to be terrified, and they don't know if the threat is coming towards them or what the threat is. So sometimes people are forgotten, or people who are on their way to work, how do you communicate with them to tell them to stay away from work? So and that poorly communicating with the people can really cause a lot of resentment for a long time. So it's really essential.
Okay, so I'm hearing communication is really key, and how communication is delivered. How important is it, Dick, to know how your employees feel about their workplace safety, how comfortable your employees are, and what they feel?
Well, they need to be part of the safety and security team. They have to understand they have a responsibility to be protective of each other, to be concerned about each other, to speak up. For instance, domestic violence has been going up, spillover into the workplace. And with COVID, it's magnified quite a bit. And often, you know, it's usually male and female. And often the woman who is at risk may feel wrongly ashamed of the situation and hesitant to speak to management. But she might speak to her colleagues, her fellow workers, and they have an obligation to speak up to management, because not only is he a risk to her, he's a risk to everybody around her. So everybody needs to be part of the team and be protective of each other.
We're talking with Dick Sem, who has consulted on workplace security for decades. He's giving us insights on how to prevent violence in the workplace. Do you ever feel nervous about going into work due to instances of violence in the workplace or the threat of violence? Are you the type of person who thinks about exit strategies in the event of a situation? Do you feel like you would be prepared for an emergency? Tell us, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dick, you know, you said that industry matters, whether it is a school or a hospital or a theater or a restaurant or a bar. How much variation should there be in these plans?
Well, there's quite a bit of variation. For instance, if your organization deals directly with the public, which would be like healthcare, retail, hospitality, even schools, you know, the greatest threat may be from the outside. It may be some member of the public, a visitor, a parent, a customer, a patient. So you need to plan for that. If you're in a manufacturer or office environment, it may not be so much the public. It may be an employee or an ex-employee or contractor. So you focus on that. In some cases, the mass shooter may be more likely. In some cases, it's going to be an isolated, targeted incident. So understanding your industry and what the risks and history are within your industry can be very helpful.
Yeah. You've been in this industry for decades now. What place does technology have in workplace violence and how you stop it?
Well, you know, technology, the use of cameras, panic buttons, alarms, access control, all of that has a value. For instance, panic or duress buttons, where somebody can hit a button for some response, whether it's security or law enforcement. Having cameras on the space so the incident can be assessed as responders are approaching can be useful. So technology certainly doesn't hurt.
Michael is joining us from Delton. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. Just a kind of a quick devil's advocate kind of question here. With the whole in-house training to prevent, you know, the disgruntled ex-employee mass shooting kind of situation, isn't that kind of also training who and teaching who the mass shooter, where the people are going to be and what the security measures are, where wouldn't in a more perfect scenario be an outside security force or more sort of a private sort of situation?
Michael, thanks. Dick, yeah.
Well, you know, I know there's a concern that if we tell people how we're going to react, that that's given them a tip. But, you know, in reality, that hasn't been much of an issue or hasn't been a reality. You know, to do that, you can't cover, there's no 100% security, so you can't cover every contingency. So you do the best you can. And, you know, I think having the proper training and alerting to somebody who's potentially violent at an early stage is highly valuable.
So as we start to wrap up here, Dick, if a company, a business could do something today to improve their workplace security, what would it be?
I guess there's many things they could do, but I'd have to boil it down most essentially is just train your people. You know, understand, first of all, a civil and respectful workplace tends to be a safer workplace. So hopefully, you know, you treat your people by the golden rule and treat them with respect. That certainly goes a long way. But you have to train your people to recognize potential violence, to be able to report, to be able to do the right thing when things get hazardous.
Dick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dick Sem is president and owner of Sem Security Management in Burlington. Just ahead, we talk with a clinical social worker about why some men abuse their intimate partners as health experts fear there is a pandemic of domestic abuse happening now. We discuss treatment to break the cycle. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.